Hello, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, the Heart Guy, and I welcome you to another exciting and informative podcast titled The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter, bringing you interesting discussions and conversations related to the vast and important subject of advanced heart disease, organ failure, and organ donation, and everything related to those topics in today's evolving world of medical advancement. I'm extremely honored to have as my special guest today an inspiring leader and expert in our global health community, Dr. Julio Gutierrez. Dr. Gutierrez is a hepatologist, gastroenterologist, and expert in liver disease. Dr. Gutierrez completed medical school at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in 2007. He then went on to his residency in internal medicine at University of California, San Diego. His further study earned him two fellowships, the first in 2012 at University of California, San Diego School of Medicine in gastroenterology, followed by a second fellowship in transplant hepatology at University of Miami, Jackson Memorial Hospital, transplant hepatology in 2014. Dr. Gutierrez is well recognized as an authority in hepatitis B and C, fatty liver, and alcoholic liver disease. In addition, he specializes in liver cancer, cirrhosis, and those who need or have had liver transplant. Finally, Dr. Gutierrez enjoys spending time with his two daughters and wife, playing guitar and fishing. He and his family also enjoy traveling and are often visiting his wife's family in Cartagena, Colombia. Dr. Gutierrez, welcome to the Heart of the Matter.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. I look forward to learning a lot about everything new that's going on in your world. So just to get started, where did you grow up and when did you know that you wanted to be a doctor?
Gary, I grew up in Northern California. My parents were students at UC Berkeley, and I think they might have even been something called hippies at the time. And so I was born there, and then my father always inspired me to pursue a career in medicine, and so it was something that I had in my mind from a very long period of time. But sort of the connection to liver disease started with my roommate while I was at Cal. Myself, his girlfriend's mother was a researcher at Mount Sinai, and they kind of one-off recruited me to go there and start studying liver disease right after I graduated from UC Berkeley. And it led me down this path to be a transplant hepatologist. And I immediately sort of fell in love with studying liver disease, and really from a very young age, I was 22. And I've really never looked back.
Wow. And that's unusual to actually know at that young an age even that you wanted to do something so specific. And so your concentration in medicine is liver disease. And just a few statistics, I don't like to do too much data, but it turns out that more than 50 million people in the world have liver disease and 4.5 million people, adults in this country. And while the most common causes are viral hepatitis and alcohol abuse, there are many other types of liver diseases. Can you tell me more about liver disease in general terms and also about some of these more rare forms of liver disease?
Yeah, well, Gary, you know, the liver is very critical for homeostasis of normal health. It contributes to nutrition, immunity, overall well-being. And so when the liver is compromised, you know, it affects the whole body. But unfortunately, it does it in a way that really is subclinical, and it's sort of the stealth jet of diseases, and that people can have undiagnosed liver disease for years and years without knowing it. And the end stage manifestation of all of this can be cirrhosis. And cirrhosis really implies the amount of scar tissue in the liver. You know, there's four stages of scar tissue. Stage four is cirrhosis. Mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time with my patients talking about cirrhosis is not just from alcohol, and that there's a lot of other causes of liver disease, including rare autoimmune conditions that can cause a disease like primary biliary cholangitis, right, autoimmune hepatitis. More common ones you've already mentioned, viral hepatitis like Hep C and hepatitis B. But really, we have a dual epidemic in our country right now of fatty liver from obesity and fatty liver from alcoholic liver disease. And both those two conditions lead to similar manifestations in the liver, which is an abundance of fat. The fat becomes toxic in some patients and then can lead to cirrhosis, especially in those patients with fatty liver. But in those patients with alcohol use disorder, we're seeing a rise in a very severe condition called alcoholic hepatitis. And that especially can happen in very young people. And, you know, Gary, one thing I want to share with you is this is a real big problem right now with the epidemic. And we've seen a lot of people succumb to alcohol use disorder, become very ill, turn yellow, go into liver failure. So it's one of the leading causes of liver failure right now. And it's very sad.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people had sort of made light of the idea that they're dealing with the pandemic by buying a lot of wine, having alcohol, you know, delivered and all that and drinking more. And they sort of, you know, say it in a, you know, in a humorous way, but it's anything but that, as it turns out.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've, as you mentioned, we've seen a huge uptick over 450% in online alcohol sales. We've seen, you know, if you go to your Smart and Final and you're in the vegetable section, you might notice that there's a stack of, you know, king size vodka bottles there waiting for you to take home with you instead of avocados. And, you know, it's become a thing that people who usually wouldn't maybe drink until after they arrived home from work, maybe start doing it earlier and earlier in the day. And so it's changed people's behaviors quite a bit.
And the effect that you're seeing is mostly in younger people, 30 and under, or everybody?
Well, I think we see it a little bit in everybody. You know, people who have, say, chronic liver disease, who've been at it a while, we're seeing them come in kind of at a regularly increased pace. But it's just very dramatic to see it in the young people. I mean, it's become so dramatic that we established a pathway for patients with severe acute alcoholic hepatitis for liver transplant. And we did this in the setting of the start of the pandemic because it just started happening so much. It's a very challenging path for patients. So far, only about 3% of patients who present with this syndrome will ultimately qualify for liver transplant. But I think it's important because we're able to offer, you know, family and friends and patients some hope.
Incredible. So when does liver disease become serious enough that someone would need a liver transplant?
Well, we have a scoring system called the MELD score, the model for end-stage liver disease. And it's based on four laboratory parameters that go into an equation that spits out a number. So a low MELD score or normal MELD score is 7. If the bilirubin, INR, creatinine, or sodium become abnormal, MELD score will start to increase. The maximum number is 40. The mean MELD at transplant in our region, which is Southern California, is about 30. So people will have to get pretty sick to get to 30. And what's interesting is some people just can't get that sick, you know, especially older females have a hard time getting to MELD scores that high enough to achieve a liver transplant. So there's some inequities with the scoring system, but it was actually designed to combat these kind of inequities because another scoring system that we had before had more subjective measures. So this was developing the score was really a way of trying to remove those, but we still have some inequities with the scoring system. And then we have regional inequities, as you probably know too, Gary, that just in California, it's much harder to get a transplant than in other areas. So Patients tend to have to get a, say, higher MELD score in California than they would if they were in Louisiana or Florida, for example.
Yeah, and that's kind of the opposite to what we're experiencing here with hearts, because in California, it seems that the numbers are most favorable in terms of getting transplant or available hearts, as they are, you know, as compared to the Northeast here.
It's not unusual for me to talk to my patients about a referral to another center if they have the means. Those patients are usually individuals who have private insurance. They're able to go to other states and seek liver transplant and maybe be on multiple transplant lists. Folks who are, say, California State Medi-Cal would not be eligible to go to another state to get a transplant. So those folks would stay in California. But, you know, it's It is interesting, and it's a complicated thing to understand. Really, I've spent years trying to understand it.
Yeah, and it continues to be. So with hearts right now, DBD hearts, basically there's a 4-hour window to get the heart transplanted. In the case of liver transplant, is there a longer period of time that's allowed to transplant from the donor to the recipient?
Yeah, well, you know, we're blessed with livers that they're very immune tolerant. They behave much better than other organs, and they do much better out of the body than other organs. And we now even have a pump that we can utilize to protect the liver from ischemia when outside of the body. And we've been using that pump at Scripps, and we've had amazing success. It's really allowed us to expand the organ pool, using older organs or organs with higher fat content. But these organs can be outside of the body for 11 hours and sometimes longer. You know, it's not perfect. You'd prefer to have the organ out for just a very short period of time, but it's feasible for somebody to, you know, fly up to another state. For instance, you know, we're in San Diego, so somebody could fly to, say, Utah, Arizona, Northern California, and then return. And then there's still, you know, back table that they have to do and preparation for the transplant.
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, the transplant operations are extremely complicated and aren't done until they're done. I really understand that. I think everybody who listens at this point to my podcast understands that these things aren't done until they're actually finished.
And, you know, just to point out, I'm the medical guy. I'm not the surgeon. I have an amazing surgical team who does all this stuff while I'm usually asleep.
Yes.
So I'm very grateful to my surgeons. I have three wonderful surgeons, Dr. Marsh, Dr. Schaefer, and Dr. Fisher. So really great
team. Yeah. Yeah. And that's generally the model for that. You know, it's a team of people, some who take care of, like yourself, before and after the actual operation. And then, of course, the surgeons who perform the operation, who are equally important. So that it's all important. We do know now, I've learned for myself, that we're starting with heart transplants to, there's an availability that's beginning in trials, at least for DCD hearts as well, where the heart is going to be able to be functional for more than the typical 4 hours that we've had for the past 50 years. So that's pretty promising. So it might actually become similar to the liver transplant in that way, which would increase the number of hearts available by as much as 70 or 80%. So, you know, that's really happening right now. And it's very promising. So we're thankful for that and all this technology that's going on. So how long can someone who has a liver transplant be expected to live?
Well, 95% of our patients will make it out of the first year. And then beyond that, you know, my oldest transplant patient who actually died this year was 94 years old.
Wow.
So I wouldn't really put a limit on longevity in a patient who does well with transplant. You know, the liver, especially with the conditions that we've talked about for the most part, hepatitis C, fatty liver, alcohol use disorder, those tend not to recur in the new grafted organ. So the organs actually do pretty well. And what ends up catching up with people is usually the side effects of immune suppression, which can, you know, incite diabetes, hyperlipidemia, chronic kidney disease. And so the grafted organ does excellent. It's very immune tolerant. We've got an easy job compared to some of the other immunology organ specialties. Our organ can even tolerate something called operational withdrawal, which is in about a third of patients who are long-term survivors of liver transplant. If you slowly and cautiously start to withdraw immune suppression, you'll see about a third of patients tolerate not being on any immune suppression at some point.
Wow, that's good.
And so it's a very immune tolerant organ. And really that's the balance I'm trying to find with my long-term survivors. How far can I take this? How far can I push immune suppression down? And in the liver, it begins to be populated by these chimeras that are half donor, half recipient. And they sort of survey and protect the grafted organ. And so we're really blessed in liver transplant to have this. You know, it used to be we would see very severe recurrence, especially of viral hepatitis post-transplant. Mm-hmm. But hep C is curable. And so our long-term survivors are doing great right now. We're doing really good in liver transplant. And, you know, I think what we need are more immunologic tools so that we can push back some of these other side effects, like I mentioned, diabetes, especially, and cardiovascular disease. And I think that would help our patients even more.
Yeah, and it's all connected. There's been the Johns Hopkins study that they've been doing as far as immunosuppression, which is, you know, a challenge now because it seems as though people who are immunosuppressed, as you suggest, don't build the antibodies right now. And they're trying to figure out if a third vaccine would do the trick. And I think that's all going on right now with a small population of patients who are involved with that Johns Hopkins study. So that's the other, you know, the other challenge is that we get transplanted and then we can't leave the house because we have no antibodies to this virus.
Yeah. And what's interesting too, Gary, is that the medications that we use in part for transplant are also being considered as therapeutics for COVID. And when we look at individuals who are post-transplant and how do they do with COVID infection, they've actually done pretty well and very similar to other individuals who are not on immune suppression. Hmm. Having said that, we still want everybody to get vaccinated. And what we're seeing is that there's lower antibody titers in patients who are vaccinated when they have a history of immune suppression. So there definitely needs to be some different approach with these patients. And, you know, we've been at this for a while. I mean, we have different approaches with other vaccine in our transplanted patients. So we've known that this was going to be a problem, but I think the initial push was, well, let's just get people vaccinated and see what this looks like. And I think there's going to be some different approach for patients who are immune compromised when we're using these type of vaccines. I think, you know, there's just the other problem was in the trials, immune suppression wasn't exclusionary to participate in the early clinical trials. So we had like zero data about what to expect in these patients. Chronic liver disease was exclusionary as well. You know, so they wanted normal, healthy people to be in those studies. But unfortunately, it leaves us with a real gap in understanding how to vaccinate people who are a little bit different.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting because all of this is going on right now and we're reacting to the pandemic, and everything that you're doing is just in response to what you see as far as results with your patients. It's extraordinary to sort of be a part of history this way. So you've studied hepatitis C, you know, and NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, and you've noticed liver disease-related healthcare disparities. Since these disproportionately affect Latinos, is this a cultural issue or an inherited issue?
That's a great question, Gary. You know, for many years, people assumed that the disparities in liver disease were related to diet, alcohol use, and noncompliance in Latinos. And then a very famous study was performed in 2004 called the Dallas Heart Study. And in this study, they performed genome-wide association studies to examine multiple single nucleotide polymorphisms or the genetics of individuals. And they correlated it with pieces of information like, does the patient have fatty liver or not? And what they discovered is all the ethnic variation in fatty liver was explained by a single nucleotide polymorphism in the gene coding for PNPLA3. I like to call this gene pineapple 3. So pineapple 3 explains all the ethnic variation of fatty liver in Latinos. And then for the next 15 years, really this information was buried. And when drugs were being designed, they weren't being designed with this in mind. Clinical trials were not genotyping patients to find out if they were PNPLA3 carriers or not. And then now with the failure of many drugs in fatty liver, now the attention has turned back to PNPLA3. And what we're seeing is a few new drugs coming down the pipeline that are all small inhibitory RNAs to target PNPLA3 on the oligonucleotide level. It's very exciting. Obviously, the patients have to be carriers for this polymorphism. And it really addresses an inequity here in terms of how Latinos are affected by liver disease. This, the presence of this gene and other genes like it, it probably explains the more rapid fibrosis progression that Latinos experience in liver disease. And what's really fascinating is that there's another separate topic called the Hispanic paradox. And essentially what the Hispanic paradox is that even though you might expect for Latinos to not live as long as their Caucasian counterparts, they actually live longer, 2 to 3 years. And they beat Caucasians in 12 out of the top 15 causes of death. But where they lose, number one is diabetes, number two, liver disease, and number three, homicide. So addressing the inequities of liver disease and diabetes, which are almost the same thing in Latinos, is very important. I think it's very important for the health of our country and, you know, looking at healthcare inequities and many other reasons to look at this carefully. So I'm really excited about the progress we've made recently. And because of the liver disease being so rampant in the Latino community, last 2 years were the first time we've ever seen Latinos receive more than half of the liver transplants in the state of California. And I think it reflects not only the high prevalence of liver disease in this population, but also what's been done with the expansion of Medicaid, giving the opportunity for more and more people to have access to liver transplant. Yeah. And so, I mean, we've made a lot of progress in a pretty short period of time, I think, with that as well.
Wow. So fascinating. Thank you for that. And with that, so, you know, our listeners, I think, are really benefiting from this extraordinary information that you provided here for us. How may our listeners either reach you or find out more about liver disease if they find themselves needing help for themselves or for a family member?
You know, I welcome meeting your listeners and helping them with their family's medical problems or their own medical problems. I have a clinic at Scripps Clinic. Of course, I'd be grateful to meet anybody in clinic. And pretty much if you Google me, you'll find my office number and my contact information. And then, you know, I'm always glad to receive emails. And if there's a way to share my email on your podcast.
Yeah, I'll put it in the notes for sure. I'll put all that information in the notes.
Yeah. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah. And thank you for that. Thank you for your generosity there. This has been my great honor to have you as a guest on The Heart of the Matter. And on behalf of myself and our listeners, I thank you so much for all you're doing in your local community there and the global community also with your incredible cutting edge work in fighting liver disease and helping people who have acquired liver disease to live longer and healthier lives. And of course, for sharing this time with us. I hope we can do this again soon.
Thanks a lot, Gary. I really appreciate it. And you have a wonderful program that you're running here. And I wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, thanks. No, I'm privileged to do it and learning as much as everybody else is while I present our discussion. So thank you for that. That's our podcast for today. Please join me next time for another intriguing, informative, and entertaining conversation. Please visit our website at www.drhearttoheart.net. for upcoming podcasts, or if you'd like me to host an online presentation for your group or organization. If you'd like to be a guest on The Heart of the Matter podcast, please email me at theheartguyspeaks@gmail.com. Our podcast can be found on Apple iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and several other platforms if you search The Heart Guy Presents The Heart of the Matter. And until next time, this is Dr. Gary Sherman wishing you peace and hope.